Are you also tired of one-size-fits-all weight loss plans? Meet Noom, the personalized solution that meets you where you are. Noom is able to understand your unique needs, from dietary restrictions to medical concerns. Unlike restrictive programs, Noom embraces your lifestyle and choices. Discover a sustainable approach to weight loss, tailored just for you. Honestly, Noom felt like it was made for me. It's not just about what I eat. It's about understanding why. With Noom, I've learned so much about myself and built healthier habits that stick. It's all about progress, not perfection. Say goodbye to restrictive diets and experience the Noom app for yourself with personalized lessons and expert coaching. Noom's psychology and biology-based approach has helped over 5.2 million people achieve their goals. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
This is episode 51 of Books and Ideas, and I'm your host, Dr. Ginger Campbell. Today I'm going to be talking with Dr. Jacques Panksepp about the emotional lives of animals. This is Dr. Panksepp's first time on Books and Ideas, but he has been my guest twice on the Brain Science podcast. In episode 65, we talked about his classic textbook, Affective Neuroscience, The Foundations of Human and Animal Emotions. And more recently, in episode 91, we talked about his new book, The Archaeology of Mind, Neuroevolutionary Origins of Human Emotions. Dr. Panksepp is a pioneer in the field of affective neuroscience, but today we're going to be discussing the implications of his discovery for our relationship with animals. I will be back after the interview to sum up the main ideas, but before we jump into the interview, I just want to remind you that complete show notes and free episode transcripts are available for every episode of Books and Ideas. They're on our website at booksandideas.com. And you can send me email at docartemis@gmail.com. Jacques, it's great to have you on Books and Ideas, and really a special privilege to get to talk to you again so soon.
Thanks, Ginger.
So for the sake of my listeners who might be new to your work, would you take just a few minutes to tell us just a little bit about your background?
Sure. I'm Jacques Panksepp, professor of animal sciences and neuroscience here at Washington State University. We have a center for the study of animal well-being. The goal of our group is to better understand the nature of animals, both their minds and their behaviors, in order to improve research and improve our understanding of the other creatures in the world. I originally started off in clinical psychology in my graduate work. I was interested in emotions and how emotional disorders might be manifested within the human brain. Back in the 60s, there wasn't much work on that, so I shifted to what's called psychobiology or physiological psychology and never turned around.
Does that mean you started working with animals, studying with animals pretty early on?
Yes, it was early in graduate school, and I was fortunate to be in a Veterans Administration hospital having a traineeship there for clinical psychology, but ended up in the EEG laboratory, and they had an animal lab there, and I was given pretty much carte blanche to pursue whatever I was interested in.
Now you are pretty much known as the pioneer of the field that's become affective neuroscience. Could you tell my listeners what that is?
Well, affective neuroscience is the attempt to actually understand what our emotional feelings are all about within the brain. Clearly, everyone is interested in the nature of these powerful feelings, but to really understand them, you have to dip deeply into the brain, and there's no real alternative but animal brain research. So if we ever want to have an answer to this question, working carefully and sensitively with the other animals is absolutely essential.
You shared quite a few papers with me, and I remember one of the things you sent me a few months ago was an article, I think, from Discover Magazine. It was a very nice interview of you. in that article, you mentioned that early on in your career, you had done some work with dogs.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't able to continue that, but that work still had a great influence on your career, didn't it?
Oh, yes. At Bowling Green State University, I think we had the very best canine behavioral research laboratory in the country. It was put together by John Paul Scott, one of the greats in the field, the person that started the field of behavior genetics. He was especially interested in different breeds of dogs that had been selected for certain traits. So we had a variety of dogs. You know, I participated in that research enterprise when I first had an idea of how social bonding was organized in the brain. This was in the early 70s, and we thought that social attachment was an addictive process. Brain opioids had just been discovered, so John Paul asked me to come join the research group and test these ideas. So we did a lot of work on dogs.
Well, we're going to come back to this whole idea about whether bonding is addictive. That sounds pretty controversial. I don't want to get off on a tangent just yet. You've been, I guess now for decades, a proponent of what's to those outside of science might seem as its surprisingly unpopular idea that animals, including all mammals, have emotional lives. Can you talk very briefly about how you reached that conclusion?
Well, I think I reached the conclusion, as many people do, which is an argument from empathy and an argument from evolution. Certainly even Charles Darwin, who wrote one of the wonderful books on emotions in humans and animals, in 1872 it was published, and he indicated that among mammals, our mental differences are one of degree and not of kind. So many people do believe this, and it's an argument from empathy, and how you translate the empathetic conclusion into a scientific conclusion has been the problem. And my argument has been that neuroscience is an absolutely essential key to that. So much of my research has been very open about the likelihood, and many people, not necessarily scientists, agree with that, because scientists believe in extreme skepticism, as do I. But, you know, we also believe in the weight of evidence. And I think now we have the weight of evidence on our side, not just a matter of arguments from empathy.
Right. Because for those of us who have pets, the idea that animals have emotion seems obvious.
You bet.
But so many scientists that work with animals seem to be reluctant to accept the evidence. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's a long tradition, and it goes back certainly to Rene Descartes, who wrote a book on the passions. And, you know, he pretty much tried to argue that animals were zombies without feelings. And since then, he was such a respected philosopher that those traditions came into science, and scientists do have to partake in a deep skepticism before there are abundant facts. And very often scientists decide that certain questions cannot be answered. And I think that was the conclusion that most people assumed, that we can never tackle this empirically. And maybe without brain research, we can't in any deep way. But with brain research, it's a different ballgame. And many of the people that develop these biases, for instance, the American behaviorists like B.F. Skinner, that governed thinking in our field for many, many decades. You know, everyone was taught that the mantra was that you cannot go to the experiential level in animals. You have to stay at the behavioral level. But they didn't do neuroscience. And once you start doing neuroscience, it opens up possibilities that could not be addressed before.
And just like until recent decades, people thought we couldn't study consciousness either. And neuroscience is changing that too.
Absolutely. Consciousness, a very hot topic in neuroscience. And you know, there's a biannual consciousness meeting at the University of Arizona in Tucson. It's well attended and discussions are proceeding. But even at the human level, people talk about the correlates of consciousness, namely what is happening when people are having experiences. And many are not willing to extend this same possibility to the other animals yet. So I guess I'd ended up being a lonely soul that said, we can go there. And because of the continuity of consciousness across species, you know, we might have a very, very complex special form, but at the fundamental level, namely the experiential level, we share a lot with the other animals. Otherwise, we would not have the experiences that we do.
Yeah, I mean, after all, if we assume that when an animal feels hungry, that's something like what we experience when we feel hungry, why should we think that the other feelings are off limits for them? Doesn't really make sense to me, but there's a lot of legacy in the system that you have to overcome, I guess. We don't have time to explore the evidence in great detail today, so I'm going to refer my listeners back to episode 65 and 91 of the Brain Science Podcast, and also to your books, Effective Neuroscience and the new one, The Archaeology of Mind. But today, I do want to focus on the implications of your discoveries as far as how humans relate to animals, and especially how we ought to treat animals that we use in scientific research.
Well, I certainly agree that we are finally at a point where we can make a science of certain aspects of animal consciousness, especially their affective, emotional feelings that I've been working on, but certainly many other feelings like hunger and thirst. We have a lot of evidence how it's organized in the brain, and that illuminates our own hunger and thirst enormously, more than any other kind of evidence. We're at a point in time where we need to integrate this knowledge into the human sciences, and that is going to be a very difficult problem. So there's that problem of solving the scientific conversation that needs to take place. And then there's also the implications for society. With regard to the implications, that is more of a philosophical issue, a moral issue. There are enormous number of opinions, but I guess my position is that the evidence that the other animals do have these fundamental experiences, the emotional feelings, bodily feelings, opens up a new level of discussing what we do and what is ethically appropriate. I don't want to draw any final conclusions here because there are all kinds of cost-benefit issues in society that need to be addressed. Certainly, one issue is how we get our calories. Most of us eat a certain amount of meat. Many people have chosen not to eat any meat at all. Often this is a health issue, but more often it's an ethical issue. You know, each person, in a sense, has to decide on these, but also the science is going to have implications on how we treat animals within our society. So laws will be passed, and laws have already been passed that try to support animal well-being and welfare. And I think those are going in a civilized direction, basically, accepting the evidence and deriving societal policies based on those kinds of evidence.
The most obvious question that we may not answer, but we need to at least acknowledge, is the question of, should we use mammals in research, since we know that the evidence for their emotional lives is pretty overwhelming?
Yes, that is a forefront question. And the way I've thought about it is that there are some ultimate values. And I think one of the ultimate values of the human species is to truly understand the world and the universe as it is scientifically. We have the issue of studying our bodies, and we can be absolutely sure that we have learned more about how our bodies operate by studying the homologous, the evolutionarily related processes in other animals. So an enormous amount of modern medicine has come from that knowledge. And I think the same will apply for psychiatry. Biological psychiatry, until quite recently, was a hit-and-miss proposition. People find new chemistries, and they see if they can develop a new medicine based on these chemistries. But psychiatry is really the science of emotional problems of the brain. That's the fundamental issue. People would not have psychiatric problems like depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorders unless they had certain kinds of imbalanced emotional feelings. So in order to develop new medicines for this, we have to understand how emotional feelings are organized in the brain. And the very best models that we have to do that systematically are animal models. So my own research has been devoted to that. And I think there is an ultimate value in acquiring new knowledge. So I support continuing animal research using much more sensitive procedures, certainly accepting that they have emotional feelings, but also trying to actually understand our own feelings through the study of other animals. How that plays out in the long run, I don't know. Maybe we will reach a point where we have sufficient knowledge. And then, of course, at that point, one might say, why do we need to continue this? And, of course, the obvious answer would be to educate future generations on how humans try to remain honest about the world and not fall back into all kinds of stories and mythologies that we've had historically.
I share your position that at the present time we still need animals in research, but how can we adjust the way we treat them so that we can treat them more humanely given what we now know about their emotions?
Well, I think there are so many possibilities that it's truly remarkable. Most laboratories use rats and mice. Those species are used more than any other. Now, of course, we've had a very mixed relationship with those species because they have given us diseases across the centuries, carried parasites and bugs that, you know, led to plagues. So now, you know, we have these animals as essentially a captive audience. They have been bred for research. As we bred them for research, we have selected them for being easy to handle. But at the same time, we haven't considered their emotional feelings completely. You know, it's a very common procedure in the laboratory to pick animals up by the tail as opposed to the body.
So you don't get bit.
So it's easy to do. It's almost like a handle. And people have done research now on how does an animal behave in a laboratory when you pick them up by the tail or you pick them up by the hand. And it's very clear that the animal gets much more anxious if you pick them up by the tail than the whole hand. If you pick them up by the tail and then you put your hand in the cage, they avoid your hand. If you pick them up by the body, they actually approach your hand. They like certain kinds of handling, and we will get better results if we don't stress them. Let's say if we're putting them in a learning experiment, a stressed animal will show different behavior. Let me take another very common example. If we use albino rats, we have to tell them apart, and we can't tell them apart by their face or the specific sounds they make, so we mark them, and we often mark their tails. Well, it turns out the animals dislike the smell of our pins enormously. So if we test an animal soon after marking them that way, our data is going to be modified by that. There are truly many examples of these everyday laboratory procedures that modify the quality of animal that you have. And often these issues are not taken into consideration. One of my colleagues here, Sylvie Cloutier, she has become very fond of this procedure that we developed of tickling animals and getting this laughter-type vocalization. And she has been testing animals that have been tickled or not tickled. And that tickled animals give different kinds of behaviors that are statistically significantly different from animals that haven't been tickled. Again, taking the animal emotion seriously opens up a variety of possibilities how you can do research better. And many people haven't really considered these issues yet.
I remember there was an example in Archaeology of Mind where you talked about replacing foot shocks with puffs of air. Could you talk about that example briefly?
Well, the foot shocks have been the most common way to study anxiety and fear, and perhaps to produce animal models of post-traumatic stress disorders. You know, shocks are very easy to quantify in terms of current levels, but we know that the animal experiences pain. Pain is one of those fundamental sensory feelings that allow us to survive. can we study stressors with more mild manipulations? Animals don't like to have an air puff blown at them. Now, we can be confident that the air puff is not painful. It's more of a startle and kind of a, oh, I don't like that kind of response. The question is, can we use more mild stressors to get exactly the same kind of information that people have been getting with foot shock? And, you know, I think we have to have a discussion about these, and people that want to study stressors, I think it's wise for them to at least compare their stressors, and if they can get the same results with a mild stressor, then I think it's a wise ethical judgment to move to that.
And if you're trying to study something like fear, which I guess is a real popular one, and you're using something like foot shocks, how do you know you're not studying aversion to pain rather than true fear? I mean, I guess you can't know.
Well, pain and fear are intimately related. It's sort of like sugar and sweetness are intimately related.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are certain stimuli in the world that automatically seem to activate an emotional system, and pain certainly has that characteristic. So if an animal is placed into a box, it just explores, checking out every corner. But if it gets one shock in that box, that's all that's needed. And then the next day you bring it back to that box, they will not explore. They will sit there and they will freeze. So it's a very, very reliable response, you know, and I think scientists always want very reliable procedures, so there's not a lot of variability to deal with. So pain provides that. But the question is, can you study fear without pain? And I think you can, because you can stimulate the brain and you can produce a fear response. You can actually produce a low-level fear response like freezing, or you can produce a higher level of fear like fleeing or running away. There's no indication that that stimulation is painful, because a very clear response to acute pain is a squeal, and certainly foot shock always initially produces squealing, whereas activating the fear system in the brain does not produce squealing. So fear is an emotional response. It's certainly a negative feeling. Humans that have been stimulated in these brain areas in the course of other kinds of surgical maneuvers, they report this overwhelming feeling of trepidation. One person in a study was reported to say, "I'm scared to death." But that experience was without any report of any pain. It seems like we can also study emotional feelings without necessarily using pain. But the most standard procedures use foot shock.
But if we're going to acknowledge that the animals have emotions, including, and they feel pain, then we would want to eventually be able to move away from using that as much as possible, right? I mean, if we're trying to be ethical.
Yeah.
So what about your laboratory rats and mice? Hasn't your research shown that they are born afraid of the smell of cats?
Yes, that seems to be a very well-replicated phenomenon. Many, many people are using it now. It does seem like the smell of a cat has been evolutionarily built into a rat's brain, that there are receptors in the olfactory apparatus. All mammals have two types of olfaction. One is through kind of sniffing through the nose. That's to the large olfactory bulb that creatures like dogs and rats have, much larger than human beings, since they can smell so well. And there's another one called the vomeronasal organ, called Jacobson's organ. There, the animal actually samples the heavy molecules nearby. The example of that would be a snake with a forked tongue. Snakes don't see so well, but they flick out their tongues, and that forked tongue actually samples the air. They pull the tongue back and they insert it into the roof of the mouth, into Jacobson's organ, to see if there's any animals around. So animals give off these heavy molecule odors that don't carry too far. And one question we asked early on was, does the fear of cat smell, which has been known for, you know, a century, is this going through the main olfactory bulb, namely the thing that sniffs things in the air that are far away, or is it through the vomeronasal organ? We were putting our money on the olfactory bulb, but it turns out that the fear of cats goes via the vomeronasal organ, and it goes directly into the amygdala, and the amygdala is the highest headwater for the fear system. So here the molecules get directly into the fear system.
Shock, what happens if you put a rat in a box that has cat hair in one corner? I guess it starts out exploring and it finds the cat hair and it has a fear response.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, if you put it in that same box, does it remember that the cat smell was in the box?
It remembers it very well. And we did this with our favorite behavior, which is happy rough and tumble play. And when we had animals playing in a box, and then one day we just put 20 milligrams of cat hair into the box, and the play went to zero. No animal showed any play. Now, some animals freeze and just stay as far away from it as possible. Other animals seem more courageous, and they actually approach it, and they might actually manipulate and say, what is this? But it certainly shifts their desire to socially engage playfully to some kind of worry that prevents play. And when we have one day like that, we can put the animals into a totally clean box the next day, just like their play box, and the animals will not play at all the next day. And that reduction in play continues for up to a week. So it's a very long-lasting worry that the animal has. And other people have used fox urine. So there's predatory smells, several of them, that rats really dislike.
So there's the potential there for redesigning experiments that would be more humane and still be scary.
There are plenty of options. Of course, you know, smell lingers. So you really have a problem of, is some of that smell hanging around the laboratory? And that can be a nightmare for a scientist. I know one scientist that was studying fear, and he had a cat lab right next to the rat lab. And people walked freely between them. I just wonder how much of their data from those early days was polluted by people carrying the cat smell into rat experiments. But we can be sure that if you have cat smell or ferret smell or fox smell in the laboratory, your results will be different. The behaviorists didn't know about this. How many of the early behaviorists that developed these very refined tools for studying learning and memory had cats at home and went into the laboratory with the cat having sat in their lap?
So I guess given that problem of the smell, maybe coming up with more methods like the puffs of air would have a lot of advantages then.
I think the air puff is something that probably could be used, but I say probably because one would really need to do the comparisons, and it's possible that a rat will get accustomed to the air puff, and therefore it will not be as useful for as long as foot shock is capable of being used in these experiments. So there could be a lot of methodological problems.
Has your personal attitude toward lab animals changed as a result of your work?
Well, I think it's changed to the point where practically all of our research is on positive emotions. We started the science of play in animals. People prior to our work had certainly observed play in the wild, and some people had done a little bit of laboratory observation even back to 1899. There's a very famous series of papers by German scientists. But we developed procedures that anyone can use in a very straightforward, simple, highly replicable way. So we studied play, and then we looked for the positive kind of happy vocalizations that we discovered by tickling rats, and developed very simple procedures to measure the happiness level of animals. You know, we call it a psychoassay. Within 2 minutes, we can phenotype, meaning get the personality characteristic of the animal. Is it a kind of sanguine, happy type of personality, or is it a more melancholic or worried type of personality? the tickle response remains stable for the lifetime of the animal. We've selected for that genetically. We've pursued the genes, looking for new treatments for depression. And we've actually come up with terrific ideas using that procedure. If you accept the emotions of the animals, you really have a whole different way of looking for new types of psychiatric medicines. It opens up a Pandora's box, both scientifically as well as ethically.
A few days ago, my husband and I watched the documentary Project NIM. Are you familiar with that story?
This is Herb Terrace's work at Columbia?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know when this documentary was made, but it includes interviews of him and the people that worked on the project. I think they interviewed everybody except the guy that was at the Primate Center in Oklahoma where they originally got NIM. And it intersperses with the video and pictures that they took back in the 70s when they were doing it, which made it really powerful. I have to admit that after watching that, I was very much leaning toward accepting the idea that we need to quit using chimpanzees in medicine.
Yeah.
I'm going to put a link to that in the show notes because you can actually watch that on instant video on Amazon now.
I have not seen that video myself.
Yeah, you should get it because, I mean, I had the book, but I never got around to reading the book. The video is very powerful because, first of all, the real people speak for themselves, which some of them come off better than others, as you might imagine. You can get your own feel for the character of the people. And then they have the videos way back from the time that NIM was 2 or 3 weeks old to not right at the time he died. I think he died when he was 25, but throughout his life.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite powerful, and it's also a big reminder of how much things have changed since the 70s.
Yeah, enormous changes have happened.
And for lab animals, I hope that they've mostly been good.
I think they have always been in that direction since the 70s. It's very clear to me that one reason that many, many neuroscientists do not want to talk about this is because they feel that it will create problems for their research programs. Probably they would say the evidence is on the side that animals do have emotional feelings. And, you know, that's the second value of scientists. You've got to be skeptical, but then you follow the weight of evidence. Has an idea led to valid predictions over and over again? So we're right now in an era where we have to essentially bring all the evidence to bear on the discussion, and there are many people that are not ready to do that.
Jacques, on a more positive note, I want to let you talk a little bit about the discovery that rats giggle. Would you tell us how that came about?
Well, it came about quite simply. We had been studying play for a long time, and I had a postdoctoral fellow come who was a social personality psychologist, Brian Knutson, now tenured at Stanford, and he was interested in pursuing some of the play research and asked me whether there is a play vocalization, and I said, nothing that we can hear. He felt a little disappointed about that, but I said not to feel disappointed because rats communicate in the ultrasonic range, so other predators will not hear them. Ultrasonics do not carry far. They can bounce off a blade of grass. You know, it's very unlikely that a predator will notice that. I said, why don't we get ultrasonic equipment and you tell us whether there's a play vocalization? And we did that, and Brian, on the first day, found that they're showing these 50 kilohertz ultrasonic chirps. And we studied it as a play vocalization, and he used it as a measure of desire, or what we call the seeking system, and that was very effective. And then, you know, he went off to other postdocs, and I started working on the projects with undergraduate Jeff Bergdorf. And, you know, after a while, the thought just crossed my mind. Literally, I woke up one morning and I said, what if that sound is laughter? I said, well, then you test it by tickling rats. I came into the lab and said, Jeff, let's go tickle some rats. And he looked at me and said, okay. The first animal showed ultrasonics higher than we'd ever seen before. The second animal, third animal, every animal. And we never turned around because it became so fascinating.
So that fits into, as you mentioned, your play research. And I know that you're one of the people who argues that play is very important to mammals. In particular, there's this idea that I was taught that I'm suspecting might not be true now, the idea that only young mammals play. Is that true or is that an outdated idea?
Well, certainly young mammals play a lot more than old mammals. It's a very, very large effect, but I think a little bit of that play urge continues forever in some species, certainly laboratory rats, especially females. Female rats remain more playful than male rats. We think the adaptive value of that is because mothers care systems. They're designed to be devoted to the young, to have maternal behavior. Often they have to remain more attuned to what the youngsters are doing, so maybe they tend to remain more playful. We even did a mama's boy play experiment where we allowed young juvenile males to get pretty old where play is coming down. We allowed them to play with their mother once they had been separately housed for a while, or play with a strange female. And guess what? The mother was more willing to play with her own sons than a stranger male.
That doesn't seem particularly surprising.
But it's nice to see the obvious in the laboratory. What was not so obvious that sometimes the strange adult female would kind of kick the young male with a hind leg, sort of like, get out of here, get out of my face.
Can we use this information to help improve the quality of life for lab animals?
Oh, I think so. There's now been plenty of work indicating that play has all kinds of beneficial effects for the brain. It certainly tends to make happier animals. We can breed for it even. So if you take the high chirpy animals, males and females, and breed them, then you get high chirpy lines. We can get low chirpy lines. It turns out the happy, high chirpy animals tend to be resistant to depression. The low chirpy temperament, basically sad sacks, they're more prone to get depression. The play urge is so powerful that it becomes above food and water and the basic bodily needs. For the young animal, it becomes the number one motivation. And I think that's true for our own kids. So we have to learn how to use play in a more effective way at the right times of development. And we should never give our kids anti-play drugs as we do at the present.
I interviewed Stuart Brown. You know Stuart Brown's work.
I do, yes.
And we talked quite a bit about the implications of that. And even adults, as humans, we tend to sometimes become all work and no play. And in terms of mental health, that's not a good idea. And physical health, for that matter.
Let me just interject that one key question would be, how do we know that the animals feel good? Isn't it just behavior that we're looking at? Here's where the neuroscience came in. We certainly know that animals get hungry for play and they run for it just like a hungry animal for food. But once we had a very simple measure of playful mood, these chirpy sounds, Jeff Bergdorf, for his dissertation, he mapped using deep brain stimulation where the chirpy circuit was, and it turned out that every place in the brain where you got this little happy sound, the animal would turn on the stimulation themselves. So it's a reward, and that is the scientific measure for positive emotional feeling.
One of the other things that we've sort of skirted around here is that it sounds like, in general, your work confirms that mammals enjoy physical contact. You tickle them to get them to do this chirpy thing. And it seems to me that this would imply that if it's safe in terms of humane treatment, then they should be petted and played with. But this, again, goes against a lot of what most of us were taught in terms of the idea that the researcher shouldn't get attached to the animal and that sort of thing. What do you think?
Well, I guess, again, you know, it's one of those dilemma situations. I suspect that you will get different answers depending upon your relationship to the animals. An animal that likes you, and they clearly show individual preferences. You know, we showed that very easily simply by Jeff and myself both tickling or touching the animal, but one of us would tickle the animal and the other would just pet it. And it turned out that all the animals preferred the person that tickled them.
Hmm.
They don't care about being petted. Now, dogs love petting, but rats don't seem to care too much about it. So if you have a good relationship with the animal, I suspect you will have different results in your experiment than if you have a bad relationship or no relationship. And, you know, these become experimental issues. Which gives you better results? It's a debatable issue. Some might say, well, actually, you don't want to have the experimenter be part of the experiment at all. But, of course, they always are. So what are we to do? My own attitude is, in general, I think it's wise for the animals to see you as a positive aspect of their environment.
The important thing, I guess, from your data collection standpoint is that that's another variable that needs to be controlled. It can't just be going about willy-nilly.
Exactly. And if you have several people running animals, that's very common. There will be experimenter effects. You know, one of the famous studies done by John Crabb at Argonne Health Sciences University a bunch of years ago was taking some of these knockout animals, knockout mice where certain genes had been removed, and taking exactly the same animals, running exactly the same experiments in three separate laboratories around the country. And it turned out that all three laboratories on identical animals got significantly different results. So there's a ghost floating around, and that is the quality of the laboratory itself.
Have you ever met or talked with Temple Grandin?
Oh, yes. Temple and I are friends and go way back.
I guessed that you would, because she's done so much for improving the treatment of animals that are being raised for livestock mostly.
She's a livestock person, yes.
I have one of her books. It's called Animals Make Us Human.
Yes, that's the second one. The first one, I think, was Animals in Translation. They're both wonderful reads. She takes the neuroscience quite seriously. Obviously, this affective neuroscience data now essentially provides the weight of evidence that the animals do have emotional lives. Other people have accepted this for a long time, like Mark Beckoff. One of his famous quotes is, it's a waste of time to ask if dogs have feelings, because they obviously do. Now, that's the argument from empathy. Actually giving ways to understand these things scientifically is a very different kind of approach. And Temple, you know, is doing applied animal behavior these days, how to make stockyards much better for the animals to live in, how you design slaughterhouses that are not so stressful. And, you know, she's made, I think, more contributions to animal welfare in America than any other person.
Now, most of my listeners aren't likely to have any contact with laboratory animals, but they probably do have pets. So how do you think your discoveries should influence how we relate to our pets?
Well, I would say that the animals prefer to have good feelings and to have a good, solid attachment with their companions. Anything you can do to maximize that, you're maximizing the well-being and the welfare of the animal. It can take many, many different forms, but most people with pets readily accept the animals have emotional feelings. I think it's a done deal scientifically, and one has to make that part of their understanding of the world.
When I interviewed you back in 2009 and read your first book, Affective Neuroscience, I just had gotten a rescue German Shepherd. One of the deep lessons I got from your work is, this is going to sound corny, but to put it bluntly, it's not selfish to pet your dog. He wants to be petted. I think sometimes people who don't like animals think that pet owners project these feelings onto the pets, but the science doesn't support that idea.
No, I think we can anthropomorphize, namely give human qualities to the other animals that are unrealistic. But most of those are within the cognitive realm. In other words, talking about their thoughts. I mean, we don't have a way to penetrate how an animal thinks. Like Temple Grandin thinks that animals use visual images. Of course, they're not going to use language the way we do. So I think that's a very good idea. And she says that she does most of her thinking with visual images. But those kinds of things are impenetrable to science at the present time. We can certainly study how complex animals can be in complex learning situations. And that's wonderful research indicating, by golly, they can be very clever. But at the same time, they often fool us. They use a very simple procedure for where we might use a complex procedure. We have to remain open to possibilities, but that level of consciousness, namely cognitive consciousness, is a much harder problem to solve than the lower level consciousness that we share, namely affective consciousness. Talking about experience and consciousness in animals, you can't talk about a wholesale. You have to talk about levels of consciousness because it's been an evolutionary process. And, you know, one of the most fascinating things for us is that at the very bottom of consciousness, it looks like the affective feelings were the very first kind of experience that animals ever had on the face of the earth.
Yeah. And the other thing I would come away with, I'm just going to say this, is I think that if you don't want to have physical contact with your pet, you shouldn't get a mammal.
Absolutely. Mammals are touchy animals. They get very touchy if they don't get touched properly. I had an experience on my last trip to Europe. The last stop was in Lisbon, and we had supper at the colleague's family invited me over, and they had a spaniel, a very kind of a little spooky, you know, didn't know what to do with me. And, well, I just sat down and, you know, he'd sniff me, and I let him sniff me, and I didn't approach him too forwardly, but put my hand out, and he put his little chin in my hand, and, you know, I started scratching it gently. He spent the whole evening with me. He was staring at me like, where did you come from? You know exactly what I want.
There's been so much great research on the evolution of dogs recently that I have come to the conclusion that since they evolved with us, you know, and they're so in tune to us, that we have a very special responsibility toward them.
Absolutely.
And I guess in a way we do to the lab animals that have been bred also.
Yeah, I think in a sense, you know, we have to have respect for all living creatures, period, down to the lowest levels and to the highest, if that's even a meaningful concept in evolution. We know that even invertebrates seem to have a certain level of consciousness that, you know, is very, very hard to penetrate experimentally. With Robert Huber, when I was back at Bowling Green State University, he had a crayfish lab, and we asked questions such as, do crayfish like to go back to where they got addictive drugs that are addictive to humans, cocaine, amphetamine, and morphine. And the crayfish go back to places where they got these drugs, indicating they probably found the experience to be positive as opposed to negative. But golly, saying exactly what their experience is impossible.
But you can tell whether they thought it was desirable or not.
You can certainly tell whether it was good or bad, and you can also tell whether it was good in different ways and bad in different ways. And the amazing thing is that for these very low-level things, you can predict human experience. Emotional feelings have this action pattern that you see, you know, when an animal gets a rage instinctual display or a fear display, and when you produce these by stimulating the relevant brain systems the way we have done, you can essentially predict to humans and say, if a human is stimulated in this area, they will get angry. They will say that they're pissed off. And that has been the case. We've known this for 30, 40 years, that the emotional behavior we see tends to match the correct kind of emotional experience in human beings.
And if you consider that we've inherited large chunks of our nervous system from these lower animals, that really shouldn't surprise us.
Absolutely. It's a Darwinian view. Our mental differences in mammals, they're one of degree and not of kind. So we have to look at degrees of consciousness. we're not going to have animals solving mathematical problems. They're not going to be doing particle physics. You know, we have a brain that's able to symbolize the world in more complex ways than other animals. And we have language to actually mediate the symbolization. Did language evolve in the brain? Are people that say we have a language instinct correct? It doesn't look like it. It looks like language is a learned function of the upper brain almost completely. But at the lower level, we have a desire to communicate, and we want to communicate our emotions. So animals clearly want to communicate their emotions with us, just like that spaniel visiting the family in Lisbon. At this level, the science can be so strong that we can now actually generate new medicines for psychiatry.
That's exciting. Is there any recommended reading that you would suggest to someone who wanted to learn more about this? I'm going to put your books in the recommendation, but I mean, is there anything, anybody else's books or anything that you would recommend to listeners that might want to learn more?
Well, I certainly think Temple Grandin's books are very excellent summaries of where we stand. They're written for the layman. Mark Beckoff has written enormous number of books. I think they are more advocacy books. Temple's books are more a description of where the science stands right now and her own work. Damasio has written wonderful books. You know, his views have come ever closer to mine. So in his last book, Self Comes to Mind, we're pretty much on the same page. In 1994, when he wrote his book, he argued feelings were cortical, top of the brain. But now he says feelings are in the subcortical domain, based on the kind of evidence that we've been collecting.
Yeah, one of the nice things about Self Comes to Mind is that he explicitly acknowledges that he's changed his position. And why? Is there anything else you'd like to share before we close?
Well, let me suggest one book on the other side. The ethologist Nico Tinbergen, being one of the greats, he said, because subjective phenomena cannot be observed objectively in animals, it's idle to claim or deny their existence. So if one wants the other side of the story, one can go to one of his most famous students, Marion Dawkins at Oxford. She just wrote a book, Why Animals Matter. And basically she says there is nothing in the science to say that animals experience anything. Now she believes animals experience things, but she says the science isn't there yet. So she gives an advocacy for animal welfare, a very well-reasoned advocacy, but tries to say that animal consciousness is kind of irrelevant for welfare issues. There are many interesting points of view. What I really regret that I'm still living in an era where the most famous emotion researchers that are doing especially fear learning in animals, they make statements like, we will never know what an animal feels. That this book is closed to us. Well, it's not closed to us. Certain scientists are now standing in the way of progress. That's a bit of a tragedy.
What about the next generation? How are you experiencing a better response from students or more interest from students than in the past?
Well, in my undergraduate classes, I've rarely met a student that eventually doesn't see that the weight of evidence, scientific evidence, is for emotional feelings in animals. Among colleagues that have crystallized their views, it's a much harder sell right now. But I think more and more, especially individuals that need the knowledge, and the group that needs it most are psychiatrists, psychotherapy practitioners. They find this knowledge to be incredibly useful because they didn't have a way to communicate about these things before that had scientific rigor. So once our government decides that we can actually develop new psychiatric medicines by understanding the feelings of the other animals, that has not happened yet. We will have a sea change. All of a sudden, everyone will agree that this is an important topic. Money speaks. And I trust that I will see that day while I'm still around.
Well, I have really enjoyed getting to talk to you again and getting to explore these things. Even though we're talking about neuroscience, the implications for the animals is another area that I have to say that your work has really, I feel, for me, enriched the relationship I have with my pets. I only have dogs, but just being able to look at them and see, you might say, the science in action.
You bet.
Of course, it also makes me feel worse for the dogs whose people stick them out in the yard and don't understand why they're crying.
Or leave them at home all alone and they tear up the house.
And they seem to be nice enough people. It's like they have, like, I have a neighbor across the street that fits this description. It's like she has a blind spot for the whole thing, you know, and I don't know what you do about that.
Well, you tell them to get another dog, and a single pet, especially a dog, can be a very lonesome creature.
Well, that's why I always try to have two. That's why I got the rescue German Shepherd, was because I had two Goldens and one was dying from cancer. And so I didn't want the other one to be alone. And so now I have one Golden and one German Shepherd who thinks he's a guard dog.
Oh, that's wonderful. Let me tell you an anecdote about some dog research we did. We did the first tail wagging experiments in dogs, a formal experiment to see what controlled tail wagging. It led to us actually trying a new treatment for autistic kids, because we wanted autistic kids to wag their symbolic tail more, namely to want to be with other people. And it did look like the medicine was effective in about 40% of kids. But that's a long story.
So I guess we'll have to save that for another day.
Okay. Always great to talk to you. I think the service you're doing is really great. What year did you actually start?
December of 2006, so 6 years ago this month.
Wow. Well, keep it up, and let me know when your own books become available.
As you can tell from Dr. Panksepp's comments there at the end, this interview was actually recorded in December 2012, and as always, I appreciate his taking the time to talk with me. If his work is new to you, I refer you back to episodes 65 and 91 of the Brain Science Podcast. I will also have links to his books in the show notes at booksandideas.com. I want to take just a moment to talk about a few of the key take-home points. First of all, scientific evidence is overwhelming that mammals, and probably many other vertebrates, do experience what Panksepp calls the basic emotional affects. Seeking, fear, rage, lust, care, panic or grief, and play. These affects originate in subcortical circuits that humans share with other mammals. I have covered these points in great detail on the Brain Science Podcast, including a detailed discussion of Antonio Damasio's book, Self Comes to Mind, in episode 90. But today I wanted to focus on the implications of this evidence with regard to our relationship with animals. We focused mainly on lab animals and pets, although Dr. Panksepp did mention the important work that Temple Grandin has been doing with livestock. Obviously, we want to treat experimental animals as humanely as possible. This should include eliminating their use in experiments whenever possible, such as testing cosmetics. I, for one, can't see any justification for that. While some of you may disagree, Dr. Panksepp and I agree that at this point we still need animals like rats in basic research. But as he pointed out, there are things we can do differently, such as possibly replacing foot shocks with other stimuli like puffs of air or the smell of a predator. But making such changes is not trivial. New methods need validation. For example, we don't know whether the puffs would become habituated and quit being aversive stimuli. And smells can linger and really complicate experimental results. Panksepp also brought out something that I really hadn't thought about, which is how scientists can inadvertently confound their experiments, such as having the smell of a pet, like a cat, from home on their clothing, and even in how they behave toward the animals, just in something as simple as the manner in which they pick them up. Pretending that animals are automatons might make things easier, but it's not good science. Another thing we touched on was the fact that understanding that we share our basic emotional circuitry with other animals can greatly enrich our interactions with our pets, including helping us to make more informed choices. If you want a deep emotional connection with your pets, dogs are a good choice. But if you know that you don't have the time or the inclination for such a commitment, something cold-blooded might be a better choice. On the other hand, many people have been surprised at the positive impact a pet can have on their lives. On the average, people with pets are healthier and live longer. Personally, I think that understanding the neurological underpinnings of our own emotions and the fact that our pets have very similar needs at a very deep level enriches the experience. Now, I need to make just a few closing comments. First, in the most recent episode of the Brain Science Podcast, I didn't mention listener donations, but recently I've gotten emails that have indicated that people have been having problems with the PayPal buttons on the websites, most specifically on the Brain Science Podcast website. And I just wanted to mention that I'm working on fixing that. So now the donate buttons are fixed, at least on the donate page and on the transcript page. More importantly, by the time you get this episode, it's entirely possible that both the Brain Science Podcast and Books Ideas will have entirely new websites, and this problem should be resolved. Don't worry about the URLs because those will stay the same. When the new websites go online, I really look forward to your feedback. Just drop me an email at docartemis@gmail.com. Another thing I want to mention is that I've got some travels upcoming. Very soon I'm going to be going to Atlanta for a few days. In March, I will be at South by Southwest in Austin, and in April, I'm going to South Africa, specifically Johannesburg and the Kruger National Park. So if you're going to be in any of these locations and you'd like to get together, check the show notes at booksandideas.com for more details, and then just drop me an email. Don't forget that Books and Ideas has its own fan page on Facebook, and you can also post comments within the Brain Science Podcast page on Goodreads. There's a section there for Books and Ideas. I think that's it for today, but I do want to mention one other thing, and that is that this will probably be the last Books and Ideas podcast for several months. I've got some things going on, including this trip to Africa, and so I will probably wait until I get back from Africa to post another episode of Books and Ideas. However, the Brain Science Podcast will continue to come out on its usual monthly schedule. So thanks again for listening, and I look forward to talking with you again very soon. Books and Ideas is copyright 2013, Virginia Campbell, MD. You may copy this podcast to share it with others, but for any other uses or derivatives, please contact me at docartemis@gmail.com. The music for this episode is The Open Door by Beatnik Turtle. Please visit their website at beatnikturtle.com. That's spelled B-E-A-T-N-I-K.